Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Support for 20 Minute Tims is brought to you by Manscaped, who are the best in below the waist grooming. Manscaped offer precision engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped have just launched their fourth generation trimmer here on the table in front of me. That's right, you heard that right. The fourth generation, four iterations of this. Join over 4 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped, and we have an exclusive offer for you. 20% off and free worldwide shipping on a Manscaped 4.0 and all the accessories you see on the table in front of me with the discount code TIMS, T-I-M-S, at manscaped.com. That's manscaped.com, discount code TIMS. Now, Stephen, Melly, what did you used to use, though, before Manscaped came along? Because, you know, it's 2021. You can't be walking about with a big old thatch.
No. Previously, I used to just try and singe it off with fire. So light a match and try and singe them off that way.
Like that.
Totally useless. It's all about the Manscaped Lawnmower 4.0 now. And did I mention it's waterproof? There's a little light on it so you can see all the little tiny
penises,
hairs.
Melly, yes. There's a light on it. Melly, you're not a large man by any manner of means.
No. It's wee, but it's mental.
What were you using before Manscaped came along?
Sunglasses and scissors. It was dodgy.
So look, jokes aside, get 20% off using the discount code TIMS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com with our super discount code TIMS. That's TIMS. Unlock your confidence and always use the right tools for the job. Manscaped. Hello and welcome to this episode of 20 Minute Tims Extra Time. It's a wee while since we've recorded one of those. We've not had a guest worthy of bringing it back, but we do on this occasion. I am joined by author Chaz Newkey-Burden. How are we doing, Chaz?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. So, Chaz, you are an author of many books, many biographies, and the reason that we're talking to you today is because you've got your most recent book out, The Runner's Code. What is it about running that attracts you so much? Because I'll tell you, out of the three of us, because you're a keen runner, obviously, and that's what your book's about. But out of the three of us, I just need to clear this up. Melly, who wrote a passage for your book, he loves to run. Stephen has tried running. I can't do it. And it should be easy, but I can't do it.
I get bored.
I get bored. I get sore. I get really miserable really quickly. And with every step I take, I think, God, I'm just one more step further from my warm house. Is that a common complaint?
Yeah, it can be, because I mean, do you listen to anything when you go, or do you have your headphones in and music or podcast or anything?
Yeah, so I find it difficult to focus on podcasts or audiobooks, so it's music. And I'm gonna tell myself here a wee bit. When I want to get G'd up, I like to listen to a bit of Tool, a bit of rock music, a bit of anything that came through new metal. I put that on and sort of listen to a bit of that. But anytime I'm feeling stressed, I put on the La La Land soundtrack. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And I end up just going, I'm too stressed for this. And I put on something with Ryan Gosling singing, and then it just kills my motivation to run. So is there anything in the runner's code for people who just don't like to run?
Well, yeah. I mean, the reason why I run is that for the runner's glow, like the runner's high that they call it. And so what I look into in the book is how the cannabinoids, which is the thing that, you know, smoking weed creates in your body, is actually the same thing that gets released when you run. So basically, there's a reason right there to run. If you like anyone who likes a bit of 4-2-0, you can have a bit of 4-2-0 in the morning by going.
Mad
and
enough
run.
Without the gear, mate. You know, since I hit it, I got munchy say.
Partially decriminalised, anyway. But
by the way, listeners, there's going to be probably a lot of that throughout this podcast.
It's inevitable. And yeah, so the other thing is, I mean, I'm with you on audiobooks. I sort of put in the book. I sort of said how you phase out of audiobooks when you're running. So like I said, if it was a novel, like a crime novel, you never find out who done it, but you keep having to rewind to restart it. So you know the first chapter off by heart. But if you can really embrace that glow and sort of get that glow and get that high and then sort of enjoy it, the thing when you're starting is just start really, really gradually. And, you know, so you could just do like 30 seconds running, 2 minutes walking, 30 seconds running, 2 minutes walking, 30 seconds running, go home. And if you go up and down, you'll never be that far, like you said, from your home. So you can always give up earlier and then take a couple of days off and then change the increment slightly. What tends to happen is I get messages from people sometimes and they go, oh, I've entered like the marathon. And I say, right, which year? They go, oh, this year. So it's in 2 months. I go, how far can you run now? And they say, not at all. Can you help me? Yeah. I'm like, no, other than trying to desperately claw your money back, I can't help you. So I think it's start slowly, I think.
Yeah, because that was the thing for me. You know, running is, you know, exercise is really great for your mental health. And I know your previous book, Running is Cheaper Than Therapy, sort of touched on that. And you feel motivated to do it. I tried to do the couch to 5K, but I'm always very jealous. I'm really envious when I'm out just walking about. You see these people, and they're, like you say, it must be the runner's glow because they're in their stride. They look majestic. They look as if they're really powering through the kilometres, burning off these calories. But every time I run, I just feel like my body's not made for it, you know?
Mm. I mean, some people, like, some bodies are more made for it than others. And it's not necessarily the bodies that you'd think, as in it's not necessarily that are sort of like, you know, sometimes I've seen guys at running at like my local park run, and they are, there's no other way of putting it, they are big, fat, sort of heffalumps, and they are amazing at running because a lot of it's to do with the lungs anyway, and the lungs can be better inside a, you know, any sort of body. There's apps like Couch to 5K is quite a popular one. I think there's probably a park run up near you. That can be a good thing to sort of,
yeah, a couple of the boys did it. I think Melly did it, actually. Melly used to do the park run. I tried the Couch to 5K throughout lockdown, you know, when everyone had that blitz spirit and we were all baking sourdough bread and trying 5Ks and all that sort of stuff. I have done a 10K. A charity 10K, but it was just one of these ones where it was a bit like you were talking about people phoning you up about marathons. It was like I booked it like a year in advance, thinking, oh, I'll get some practice in. Then the next thing you know, it's a month away and you just have to drag your limp body around this 10K course and get those sponsorships in. I was reading a little bit on the internet about how you got started as an author, and one particular publication jumped out to me because I think everybody's familiar with this. It was Shoot.
Mm.
I mean, that is, as a wee guy, You're every week you're buying Shoot magazine, you're taking the posters out, you're putting them on your bedroom. My bedroom wall was absolutely littered with Shoot, and I think that's how most people got in touch with like most of the football superstars of the time. But that must have been like a brilliant start.
It was brilliant, yeah, because I started off just before then at 90 minutes, which was more of a sort of an irreverent, I mean, it was not far off in spirit, it was quite similar to 20 Minute Tim's actually, but then that folded because that's the effect I have on magazines. I quickly fold them when I join. And then I went, we all moved through to Shoot, and it was amazing because really my job then for like best part of, you know, 2 years probably was just interviewing probably roughly about 4 or 5 footballers a week. And it being Shoot, of course, nobody reads Shoot is interested in that guy in the second division who's like got an interesting story. They just want the stars.
Yeah.
And so I just spent 2 years, this is like late 90s, just interviewing all these different big name players. I mean, the sort of the lowest strata of players would maybe be like a left back at Everton. That would be considered the absolute sort of low point of who you could go to. Generally, it was about the same pool of about 15 players. You know, from Liverpool, Arsenal, Man U, or whatever, who we were always aiming to get. So, in fact, I mean, maybe we'll come to my Celtic story in a bit, but it was like that comes up there because that's how I first got to Celtic Park, was because I went up to interview Simon Donnelly.
Yeah.
And that was quite a day, but I'll hold that back for the Celtic bit. But yeah, it was pretty amazing. I remember I used to go to Arsenal.
This must have been the height of the Premier League coming through, wasn't it? Like the Liverpool, the Spice Boys, and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, it was exactly then. And I remember, like, I interviewed Beckham quite a few times, Shearer, Ian Wright. I mean, I generally used to just try and interview the players who I wanted to meet. And, you know, whoever they played for, I'd always sort of, I've always liked players from all teams. I mean, maybe I draw the line at, you know, at the Huns. But it's like, you know, generally speaking, I've just like, I like, you know, the footballers who I wanted to meet were generally the ones who I just found interesting. And so it was Beckham quite a few times, Roy Keane a lot of times. Wow. And he was just unreal to interview. I remember the first time I turned up, when he walked into the room, he was everything I feared he would be. He was openly, completely, not even grumpy, like hostile and potentially aggressive. It was when he was on that long layout. Do you remember when he tried to end Alfie Ngaholland's life? And he came in and he was openly, I mean, the most hostile interviewee I'd ever had. And obviously, these
footballers. Were they put up by the club? Was it like an obligation that they had to do?
This generally got them through kit sponsors. So this was through, God, I can't even remember what the, Diadora, I think it was called. And they would have like players, and part of their deal with their, you know, sponsoring their boots would be they'd have to do a certain amount of interviews a year.
Right.
So he'd know he sort of had to do it, but he would have no sort of pleasure about it. And I've always worked well kind of with people who are more reluctant. Like your happy interviewees, I generally didn't always get on well with, because I sort of thought, why are you so keen to talk to me? Whereas the ones who were like really grumpy, I thought, I can only take it up. And he was, by the end, he was amazing, totally open. In fact, he was so open, Shoot couldn't publish about 70% of what he told me, because it was just too much for a young readership.
It's quite interesting, because things like Shoot, and we'll talk a wee bit more about your career, but like, It's so cliche to say, oh, social media didn't exist back then, but that was there was no internet, there was no social media. This was the place to find out what was happening with your footballs. Obviously, there was like Football Italia on TV, and what was that? I've completely escaped my mind. There was Shooting, the other one,
Match.
That's right. And but this was it. This is how you stayed in touch with what was happening. So I can imagine when footballers, like you say, when the sponsorship deals and the brands wanted to get their footballers into these magazines, it's the equivalent to, you know, brands working with Instagram influencers and making sure the players have got these massive social media followings now.
That's right. That's right. And it was amazing, actually, the banter or the rivalry between us and Match, because Match, I make no bones about it, sold many more copies than Shoot did, but we got paid much, much more, all the staff at Shoot, and that was sort of very known. So whenever we turned up to press events, you know, they'd be quoting their you know, their circulation figures at Shoot writers, and Shoot writers would be just quoting the salaries back at them. So it was a bit like, you know, it's probably equivalent to like in the football world. But I loved it. And I mean, you know, you can't really do better. I remember one trip in particular, I went up to Manchester and spent like 2 days with the Jamaican team, who were known as the Reggae Boys at the time, and just going around on the bus with them around Manchester. And then someone said, oh, what are you doing now? I said, oh, I'm going home. I'm just interviewing Beckham on the way home. And it was in that moment where someone said to me, oh, just casually interviewing Beckham on the way home. And it's like, it become that sort of normal. Shearer, I remember, was very, very funny, because Shearer used to give you absolutely nothing. If you sat down and went, oh, Alan, it's Tuesday today, he'd say, you said that, not B. Don't quote me on that. You know, all days are valid. And if you asked him anything about England, he'd say, if selected for the next match. This was when he was, you know, the heart and, you know, the man for the England team. He'd still say if selected. But what I found was, if you caught his eye during the interview, you could make him laugh. And I did used to like doing that, because I knew as he sat there and put up this front, I didn't take it personally at all. And I just thought, inside, there's obviously someone who likes a laugh. So the more evasive he got, I would just do a very slight smirk and look straight at him as he did it. And of course, he couldn't keep his face straight at that point.
That's the game. It was kind of like the game. It's quite difficult, because obviously podcasts now are really popular and they've kind of taken over, and YouTube channels are kind of taking over podcasts a wee bit in terms of popularity. But it's quite difficult to explain to someone much younger how culturally significant magazines were as you were growing up. You know, this is how you stayed in touch with the cultures that you were interested in for the most part, and obviously fanzines and stuff which you've spoken about before. And just reading about the magazines that you worked in, you kind of followed my sort of adolescence. So you went from Shoot, as you were saying, then you ended up working for Loaded magazine, which is one of these lad mags. And just looking back to that sort of thing now, like, you could never imagine that culture's almost completely disappeared. You know, obviously it had its issues, and looking back, it's problematic. And the way that, you know, the way that it approached to topics of women and all that sort of stuff, it definitely was. Looking back, you couldn't get away with it now. But that's completely disappeared. What were your sort of memories working for Loaded and looking back? How do you view those sorts of things now?
Well, the best story I can say about how it was like to work at Loaded was they initially just sent me out to do their football interviews, because that was kind of like my niche there. And at Shoot, you had to they were great days at Shoot, but you also had to put up with a lot of nonsense from agents and from PRs, because you couldn't tell them where to go, basically. When they started having their demands, you had to sort of go along with it. And one of the first interviews, football interviews, Loaded sent me out to do was up at it was up at Ellen Road, and it was four or five England players just before Euro 2000, and it was through, I think, Burton Suits. So they're all from like different clubs. There was Kieran Dyer, Phil Neville, can't remember, Kevin Phillips, and Emil Heskey. Now, towards the end of the day, I already knew Phil Neville pretty well from the shoot day, so we got on quite well, and I got on well with the others. But then I saw Heskey turn up with some sort of agent, and the agent came bursting into the room, left Heskey in the car park, and came in and tried to do the heavy on me. He said, "I know what you Loaded boys are like. You're going to try and stitch my man up. You're not going to stitch my man up. I'm not going to let you. I'm not going to let you do a Loaded job on my this or that." He goes, "If you're not, if you're going to muck my play around, it's probably better that we cancel it." And obviously, he was bluffing it all. And yeah, because it was Loaded and not shoot, I was able to just go, "Yeah, I think we should." And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Yeah, I think we should cancel it." And he was like, no, we don't want to." I said, no, you're right. I shouldn't. Emil doesn't need to be disrespected. We should cancel it." So I was like, "No, you're right. Emil does not need to be disrespected. We'll cancel it." And he actually had to go out into the car park. And I watched from the toilet window as he explained to Emil Heskey that he had to go back to Leicester because he'd blown it, because he'd tried to do it. And it was nice. I rang up the Loaded office and I said, "I hope I haven't done wrong." They said, "You did the perfect thing and put that in the story and all that." But basically, this man tried to do it. So that was nice. It was kind of problematic. I remember interviewing Jenna Jameson, who was like the porn sort of actress. And when I sort of look back on it now, it just always feels not so much from a puritanical point of view, but I remember sort of saying, you know, having to ask her things like, you know, "What's your favourite fantasy?" And she was saying, "Oh, I like sort of lonely, ugly teenage boys." Or in other words, she was saying like the people who read Loaded and all that. And offensive. There were times where I sat there, I felt seen. But but I do remember sitting there and thinking this was not, because when I grew up, I wanted to be like the next Paul Foot or Chris Mullen. I wanted to be a fearless investigative journalist, like uncovering injustice. Instead, I was uncovering Jenna Jameson.
I know. It was because, I mean, these Loaded and FHM, I look back on it somewhat. You know, you look back at things you do when you were younger and it's all a bit cringeworthy, but you know, you have to go through these sort of cringeworthy phases. And Loaded and FHM magazines, like, I used to buy them, never read them. You know, you didn't really, because I was too young for them. They were just, but it was just cool to have them in your bedroom when your mates came around. You go, "I've got the latest FHM there. I can't afford any of the clothes in here. I can't afford any of the cars. I don't listen to any of the music and I'll never meet any of the women," but it's just cool to have these sorts of magazines about you. And obviously that culture, you grow up and you go through it, and it's disappeared now, but it's such an alien concept. The sort of lad culture is such an alien concept that's completely disappeared from our sort of cultural environment, hasn't it?
And I mean, you know, there was one actually thing that's probably worth touching on, because I was the editor of a website called icons.com between 2000-2002. Now, what we did was, it was almost like a forerunner to social media. We ran the official homepages for football, for certain footballers. So we'd like do a deal. The company would do a deal that they would host that player's official website, and that this theoretically would give that player an independent voice. Like, they didn't need to go through the club media and they didn't need to go through the media. So they didn't need to go to newspapers, magazines. They could talk through their own website. And obviously they all needed like ghostwriters, because we were updating these websites on almost a daily basis. So Henrik had a website there. I was not in charge of his website. He got assigned a journalist very quickly. But that guy obviously just had nothing but amazing things to say about what it was. I did do one Celtic player, although he wasn't at Celtic at the time. I did, of all people, Paolo Di Canio's. Wow. Now, when they told me as editor that I also did Bergkamp and Overmars and Grimondi at Arsenal, but when they told me that Di Canio...
Meet these guys?
All the time. It was like my job, like for 2 years, was to, on any given day, I mean, Overmars by this time, he moved to Barcelona soon after, so we'd only talk on the phone. I only met him once. But Grimondi, Gilles Grimondi, you remember with the afro-y hair? He used to come by the office all the time.
Wow.
I used to meet Dennis Bergkamp about once a month, and we'd speak on the phone a few times. And the stories are unreal. I'll tell you one. The rule with Dennis, he was really, really cooperative. Everyone said he wouldn't be, but we kind of weirdly hit it off. But he had certain rules. So it'd be like, never phone on a match day, never phone in the evening, blah, blah, blah. Like, you have to phone between 2 and 3, but not on a weekday or a weekend or a match day. So I always kept to that. When Arsenal won the double at Old Trafford in 2002, I got completely, like, utterly sort of wasted. And I was completely gone. And about 1 a.m, I drunk dialed Dennis Birkin. Because everything in my head was telling me not to, but all the booze in my belly was telling me to. And I'll never forget, the moment he answered, I went and just sobered up in an instant. Wow. And I thought, I have lost my job. But it was the opposite. What had happened was all of the squad had flown down from Old Trafford from Manchester to London to celebrate winning the double. And of course, he didn't fly. So he was in the back of a car with the driver who spoke neither Dutch nor English. All his friends and his wife, he said he'd rung them, and they'd all said, oh, you know, Dennis, you win trophies all the time. We can't just talk. And then suddenly he has drunk Chaz on the phone at 1 a.m. outside a kebab shop. And he just said, please talk to me. And I ended up talking to him for about an hour. And I definitely would have told him I loved him, because that's what I do, or why I don't drink anymore, when I did. But Paolo was another case. He was every bit as crazy and infuriating and everything I thought he'd be, but times a million. Now, his politics are kind of beyond problematic, but I remember the day after 9/11, I was also the editor of the Oval site, so I briefed all the journalists and I said, listen, when you do your update with your player today, obviously it'll be mostly about this weekend's matches, but see if you can get something from them, even if it's just a generic thing at the end of the post.
Paolo Di Canio on 9/11. I can't wait to hear this.
Yeah, but that was the thing. I rung him up and he said, we talked about the forthcoming West Ham match. And then I said, also, Paolo, I thought it'd be nice, you know, if we could include something on your page today about, you know, what happened in America yesterday. And he said, okay, have you got your tape running on your notebook? I said, yeah. He said, okay, this is what I want to say. And about 20 minutes later, he finished a manifesto that made George W. Bush look like Gandhi, basically. I will say this for him. It was a horrific manifesto. It was a horrific response. But I'll say a few things about it. Number one, he knew his stuff inside out. I'd watch Newsnight the night before. I'd read all the sort of highbrow papers on the way in because I was crapping myself about the future of the world. And nobody was commentating on it with the knowledge at that stage that Paolo did. It took about another week until even Newsnight were up to speed with his knowledge of, you know, militant Islam and the Middle East. That's point one. So his approach was horrific, but it was he'd obviously spent many years studying all this, which is kind of worrying in itself. The other thing is that I was on the landline at the office, but a text blew up on my phone about 1 minute into this talk from his agent. I'm sitting next to Paolo and not a word of this goes on his website or you're in trouble. But I've still got the tape somewhere. And he was hilarious. I used to go around to his house and I used to take like the emails, because we used to get emails sent in. Like there was an actual page on it, like email Paolo, which was ostensibly you could actually email him direct. In a lot of the cases, the players never saw these emails, if I'm honest. But in his case, he used to say, bring some along. And he'd say, bring some nice ones along and bring some funny ones along. So I used to bring along, like, you know, Pat Butcher, who was on EastEnders.
Yeah.
Right. So there was a lot of women who looked like her, who were West Ham fans, who used to send him massively, massively explicit suggestions and emails. And he used to sit there. He used to say, I told him about these. He said, okay, print all those off and bring them when you come to my house. So I'd bring them all over. And all I can say is the less desirable the senders were, the more explicit the suggestions. And there were some that I literally looked at and I thought, do you know what? Maybe I am a Victorian because I'm appalled by some of these suggestions. And he used to sit there crying with laughter, reading them. And those were some of the best afternoons, sitting in Paolo's house while he laughs at explicit
sort of fan mail. The sort of it's equivalent of sliding into the DMs, isn't it?
Yeah,
You send them the explicit email. You've really came through like the zeitgeist of a lot of this stuff, you know, the shoot, the loaded, then moving into later on, you're talking about, you know, even the ideas now of footballers having their own personal websites seems a wee bit antiquated, you know. I don't even know if footballers do now, sort of moving through beyond that.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I can't go any further though without picking up on something else that I read about you, that you'd managed to interview a man who is hugely influential on all the jokes that we make in our podcast. It's a disgrace to think they're like, all these jokes are like 20 years old now, almost. You know, they're all dated. It's Ricky Gervais, obviously. Anyone who watches the
Office, how old do they look?
Anyone that listens to the podcast and has watched The Office is well aware that every opportunity we get, we just shoehorn in some hacky Office reference. But we can't help it. We can't help it because, again, it was so fundamental in sort of creating our senses of humour. And that when that came out, we just hit at just the right age. And some things just hit at the right age, you know, shoot, hit at the right age, Loaded, hit at the right age. And then, you know, the Office came about. How did you end up interviewing Ricky Gervais?
That was when I worked at the Big Issue magazine. And, various sort of names would get sort of, you know, dangled into the mags, you know, did we want to interview them? And when it was him, I was like straight away, yeah, I wanted to, because Office was already out, all of The Office, but Extras, I think, was about to come out. But it was actually to promote, I think, a film he was in. But obviously all I wanted to really talk, I just wanted to meet him and I wanted to talk about The Office. Now, it was amazing. I'll be honest, at the time, I had enormous respect for his work. But going into that interview, I found him annoying because I used to see him on like Jonathan Ross and he just seemed so kind of smug and he'd do those big explosions of sort of laughter and him and Jonathan Ross were always a bit, you know, it was always
chummy, that annoying chummy way. Yeah.
There was that joke where it was on a sketch show or something and like every three scenes on this sketch show, it would be Jonathan Ross saying, and on this week's show, Mr. Wicky Gervais, because he used to be on so often. And also, I used to watch them on the not the outtakes, but like the extras, the not extras, but the extras on the Office extras. DVD.
Yeah.
And he was always a little bit kind of annoying like that. And I met him.
Did you ever watch him on the 11 o'clock show? Do you remember
when he
was
on
the
11?
No. No, yeah, I remember. That's when I first came across Ricky Gervais. He was on the 11 o'clock show with Ian Lee and what was that girl's name? I can't remember. She's a famous female comedian. But that's when I first came across Ricky Gervais on the 11 o'clock show, and they had like Ali G on it and stuff like that. You know, that's I think where he came through as well. And then when he started The Office, that's sort of, I was like, oh God, that's that guy for the 11 o'clock show. I don't know how I discovered The Office, just on TV one day, and I absolutely fell in love with it. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, it's cool. I loved him when I met him. He is, of everybody I interviewed, I've interviewed probably, I've counted up over 100 footballers / football managers, and then many dozens of kind of pop singers and actors and so forth. Of all of them, he's the one who surprised me most. And absolutely stunning, really, really nice, massively self-aware, whereas his public persona at that time was almost to pretend to be unself-aware. He had that sort of, almost like a hangover of that sort of mid-90s overconfidence that Oasis and Robbie Williams kind of used to display in interviews. And then suddenly, you know how all celebs suddenly got that like that?
Yeah.
And some could pull it off, like Liam and Noel and even Robbie, to be fair to him, could pull it off. A lot of people couldn't. He was really, really nice, but there were a few funny moments. I remember at one point he said something which, as you know from your show week in, week out, it needed the Office line to be. So I said the Office line. I can't remember the exact context, but it's like it brought up an Office line, something he said in one of the answers. And then he said the next line. Then I said the next line. Then he said the next line after that, and he got it wrong, but he didn't know he'd got it wrong. And I corrected him. Right, on his own line. And I forgot in that moment when I went, no, it doesn't go like that. And I corrected him and I said, stop getting The Office wrong or some joke like that. And then suddenly it dawned on both of us the ridiculousness of this, that he was the man who wrote it and I was sitting there rudely correcting him, and we both burst out laughing. And then at the end, oh, I made such a prat of myself. But at the end, I was talking to him as I left, and I just wanted to say to him, like, how much it meant. And I said, I really, really enjoyed meeting you. And I think I said something like, you know, you weren't how I expect. He said, oh, I come across as a complete twat on interviews, don't I? And I was like, that wasn't quite what I was going to say. He said, no, I know what you mean. He said, when I'm on TV, he said, I come across really bad. I said, look, whatever you do with that, I said, I've really enjoyed meeting you. And I just said, I was really into the Christmas special at that point. I found the Christmas special with the office. And I started talking to him about it. I started having tears in my eyes because I loved the program so much. And I couldn't believe I was getting to tell the man who wrote it. Because it's different when it's in an interview. There's a great thing about when you bump into someone in the street. That's always really nice. But when you're in an interview, I don't know, it gives you that kind of extra thing of you are already talking to them. So you don't, if you got someone in the street or in a bar, you think, I might just have 1 minute to tell them what I think. And then you get nervous and you don't know whether they really want to hear it. I mean, he might not have done anyway. But yeah, he was very nice. And that was definitely one of the highlights of thing. But the funny thing is, I remember he mentioned extras to me during the interview, and when he described it to me, I came very close to saying that sounds shit, because the thing is, I think it stands really close to The Office. Like, yeah, I get hammered.
It took me a while. Took me a while to get into it. Like, I watched it when it first came out and I thought, God, this isn't good. But then I sort of revisited it again. All right, I need to give it another chance, and it's great.
And, you know, a lot of The Office and Extras was filmed around here. The Office, because I live near Slough, but a lot of Extras wasn't. I have to tell you, it was around June. I ran over to Uxbridge, went to two Extras filming locations, took pictures of myself then, ran home listening to the 20-minute Tim's Friday phone-in, and you guys answered a question from me. And I remember, and I saw some cows on the way home, and I thought, this might be the best run I've ever had.
I mean, we do these interviews on the podcast, and we've had sort of, I've never interviewed an expert interviewer before, but, you know, we just wing it. But that nervousness you're talking about, like, I find it so difficult sometimes when you're interviewing, especially like we've had Chris Sutton on the podcast, and it takes you it takes me like 20 minutes, half an hour to not be nervous and just build up a rapport. Because just like, you're like, Christ, this is Chris Sutton I'm talking to. You know, you're like, Jesus, yeah. God. You know, I suppose it's a bit different because you're a professional and I'm winging it. You know, that's the difference.
Well, but I'm lucky in that I started so young. So I think I just didn't have, like, when I was young, I just took it for granted. It was like, my first job, proper job, involved as I said, it, which was at Shoe, as you said, like constantly going around and being, you know, driven and, you know, getting planes up to Manchester to and all that. And I think there was a part of me at that age was like, yeah, of course I'm doing this. Whereas, of course, if nowadays if someone said to me, do you want to fly up to sort of Manchester to interview, I don't know, you know, Ronaldo or Marcus Rashford or someone, I think I'd be absolutely bricking. I'd be like, me? Why me? But when you're young, you don't have that sort of self-doubt. And I think that served me well at the time. And the other thing is that because I looked at that stage very young for my age, like I think I was around early 20s when I was doing it, but I looked about 15, like literally.
By the way, can I just say, you still do. I was.
Thank you.
I only found out what age you were when I looked up your Wikipedia and I was shocked.
Yeah, well, maybe as much for the immature humour on Twitter, but and the endless fangirling of 20-minute Tims. But I think that helped me with footballers because I used to go along to like these press days where they'd be maybe be doing three or four interviews, and I'd often be able to hear the interview before. And, you know, no disrespect, well, actually lots of disrespect to the journalists, but you get these sort of fat 50-something wheezing men. Nothing wrong with being fat 50-something and wheezing. But then when you sit down with a 21-year-old professional athlete and you go, oh, I don't think your fitness has been very good this season, he's obviously going to think you're a dick. Now, for a start, I was there for Shoot. So all I was really saying was, you know, do you prefer free kicks or corners? Let's be honest, right? It was not big stuff. And they like answering stuff
favorite
like
film,
that.
Favourite film, favourite pre-match meal, you know, that
exactly,
quiz.
Yeah.
I loved that.
I mean, I remember like, yeah, it was, yeah, there was that one Focus On. And I remember one time I got time with, I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Bergkamp, but this is before I knew Dennis. So this is before the web. So I sat down and I did the normal Shoot front cover interview with him. And then I did a Focus On. And I remember that became legendary around the office because what we used to use Focus On for people who didn't read Shoot was like a Q&A at the back, which was exactly what you just said. Favorite pizza, favorite singer, who would you marry, blah, blah, blah. Favorite color. And I did one of those with Dennis and it just became legendary around the office because we used to use this for the small players that we got access to. So the idea was you'd get like a small player, you'd do a Focus On, and nobody could believe that I did a Focus On with Dennis Bergkamp. But I asked Dennis Bergkamp what his favourite colour was. But, you know, he liked it.
But like these were always, they're always interesting to look back on because you look back at, and the music taste has always had it. Footballers' music taste is typically really bad. You know, it's typically quite poor. But when you look back, they always do the rounds on Twitter, like Charlie Nicholas, Focus On. Who's your favourite band? And it's always someone absolutely horrendous from the 90s. Steve Coogan, you interviewed him as well. Were you close to him? Was this over the phone or in the same room? The reason I ask is because a friend of mine was waiting to check into a hotel and they were stood behind Steve Coogan. And the only takeaway they had from that encounter was they said he smelled rich.
Oh, right, yeah. No, well, what happened was this was one of the weirdest sort of interview stories I've got, which is, or just aware.
Was this before or after he went super Hollywood? Because there was a period in Steve Coogan's career, wasn't there? When he was doing Alan Partridge and all that sort of stuff, I think he was like normal British TV guy. But there was a
before,
period of time when he went mega Hollywood for a bit.
Yeah, it's before Hollywood. What happened was he brought out a book as Pauline Calf. He brought out a Pauline Calf book, basically, like, you know, just a Christmas.
This was a character he used to do previously.
Yeah, like she was like a Mancunian, and her phrase about everything was, I've had him, I've had him. And she'd talk about men, she'd go, I've had him, I've had him. And she had a male auto ego called Paul Calf, who was like this sort of, you know, pissed off.
Is this
the
mullet
guy
and the paint in the hand and the cigarette? Yeah, I've seen that.
And
image,
so she brought out the Pauline Calf book and we kept applying from 90 Minutes. This is before Shoot. We kept saying, can we get interview time? And they kept saying yes and then cancelling it. And it was just one of those PR things. Obviously, the PR was a bit disorganised or was getting better offers and was shunting us out of the queue and that. So what we did was we found out he was doing like a signing. So I don't know why, like, because we didn't normally do this sort of like hijacking things, but we went along. I went along with a photographer. So we sort of queued up as if we were just there to get the book signed. And then when we sat, when I got to the signing table, the photographer just jumped, took a picture of us together. I had unveiled a Man City scarf because, like, Pauline Calf's a Man City fan. And then I said, I just asked he was dressed up as Pauline Calf, and I just said, you know, what do you think of Alex Ferguson, to feed the line to him for her/him to say I've shagged him. And she said, I've shagged him. And I said, thanks for the interview for 90 minutes, can we do a photo? And they did the photo, and just as I left, he just whispered in my ear, you cheeky bastard, like that.
The Wikipedia had something else that was quite interesting for me, and before we get to Celtic stuff, I cannot do a Celtic podcast and not bring up the fact that you were subject to a complaint from royalty. Is this real? Because I know a lot of stuff on the Wikipedia is incorrect, but it said that in 2005 Prince Charles complained to the big issue about an article Chaz had written comparing Prince William to an antelope. So I think we need the comparison first and then the complaint and how, what does a complaint from Prince Charles, does it come from his lawyer? Does it come from his personal office? Does it come from him himself? How does that work?
Well, yeah, I wrote this, yeah, I wrote like a profile of, I used to write the profile at the back of the mag called The Big Name. And I used to go massively pro or massively anti whoever I was profiling. I never wrote anything in between. And I tended to try and go the way that people weren't expecting. So like I wrote one about, I think it was either Jordan or Sharon Osbourne, and like built her up as some sort of messiah. And so when it was Prince William, I just went mega bitchy. And I thought, I mean, he does have that sort of equine look to him. I don't know. He was going off to Kenya to do some sort of volunteering somewhere. And I put something like, let's hope he doesn't get mistaken for an antelope and shot. And I think it was the shot bit that annoyed his dad. And
I'm amazed that Prince Charles reads a big issue. Do you think he picks it up outside the local
Well,
Tesco,
I think that the Big Issue Foundation, which is a charity, was very close to one of his charities or something. And so this complaint came through that, you know, he didn't want to see anything like that again, or, you know, some sort of ties may be reconsidered or something. And what was quite funny was the owner of the Big Issue, the founder rather, John Bird, he came into the office one day and he had absolutely no clue that the person who wrote the article he was ranting about was in the room. He was literally perched on the side of my desk and he was effing and blinding and doing everything and going, and I was just nodding along like, yeah, yeah, Sam, yeah, whoever
this guy
it is.
Like a dick.
Yeah, we can't get him to write for us again. But it got worse. We got so many letters and stuff. And what clearly was going on, there must have been some sort of email list or something.
Right.
Because suddenly a month later, suddenly one week, we get tons of letters. And then an old woman turned up downstairs and like was waving an umbrella in my face, like menacingly, like a rolled up umbrella.
Well, wait till the Rangers fans trouble. Get hold of this. it'll all start all over again. So the reason I've got you on, obviously, is one, to talk about your book, and two, to talk about the fact that you're a Celtic fan. This is a Celtic podcast, and your journey to becoming a Celtic fan was a really, really interesting one, because it started through the Birmingham Six. It's sort of tangentially.
Yeah, so it's a sort of an odd story. So basically, 1979, I watched my first football match. And so, you know, that was Arsenal v Man United. Really dramatic ending, you know, became an Arsenal fan, went to Arsenal. That should be the end of the story. But what happened was, 10 years later, when I was about 15, 16, I bought a Pogues album, their third album. Well, I bought all their albums, but the third album had the song in it, The Birmingham Six. About the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four. I doubt there's anyone listening to this podcast who doesn't know who they are, but they were some Irishmen and an English woman who were framed for pub bombings. And there was a long campaign and they got cleared, as I'm pretty sure everyone knows. And but when I heard that song, I got involved with the Birmingham Six campaign. So that was like my student years were spent campaigning for Birmingham Six, the Winston Silk Cart, the Bridgewater Four, all these different cases. But the Birmingham Six was like the real heart of it. And I ended up like, you know, we'd travel around, visit them in prison, do vigils, lobby people. So we spent a lot of time traveling. And I fell in with this pair of Celtic fans. And Jesus, I mean, you might think you end up talking a lot about Celtic because of like, A, your passion, and B, your podcast. You hardly mention Celtic compared to these people. They just were Celtic this, Celtic that. I mean, the fact that I was sitting there and at the beginning, I didn't know what they were talking about because I didn't follow Celtic. I followed football, but not Celtic. And I sat there listening and I just loved it. I just loved listening. I'd never heard people speak about football in quite this way. I'd heard countless passionate fans. So I started looking out for Celtic score at the weekend because I just thought, oh, I want to think that they're happy. And, you know, I'd hear Lisbon Lions, Paul McStay, all these sort of things, that these names that I would soon learn sort of what they meant. And then when I started sort of, I think I bought a book or a video. No, it was a video, like a Celtic history video. And I watched that and I just remember just thinking, just completely falling in love and just going, this is it. This is the real deal. Like, this is what I want. And this is, you know. And so I sort of, I'll always remember I wrote to the fanzines and I think to the Celtic View as well. And because obviously this is pre-digital era and all that. So I wrote.
I loved this, by the way. I know what you're going to say. And I thought this is great.
This was another sort of key moment. So I sort of wrote and just said, look, can anyone like tape Celtic matches and highlights for me and I'll post you the tapes and all that. And I would just get bombarded. And this was when I realized that the Celtic fans, you know, were so special, because I would just get bombarded with videos. Like, you didn't need to send my VHSs up. People were just like, you want to watch Celtic and you can't watch them, we'll help you. So I'd get all these videos landing on my doormat from mostly from Glasgow and Northern Ireland. My mum would sort of call up and say, "There's some more packages from Northern Ireland for you." And I remember the St. Patrick's Day Massacre, like my favourite football match still to this day. And I used to watch that over and over, just watching Hurlock and Walters and Hatley get sent off, okay, especially well, yeah, Hatley, yeah. Because when you watch, it's on YouTube, when you watch Hatley get sent off, there's a guy in the main stand. And he just catches Hatley's eye. You watch him, he's focused on catching his eye, and then he just does the hand movement. And it's just absolutely perfect. And I think Hatley blows him a kiss or something. The whole match was hilarious and brilliant. And I still watch it. Like, if I'm down or whatever, I just watch a bit of St. Patrick's Day Massacre, and it makes me laugh again. Especially Hurlock. I mean, what a guy.
the archetype of Hunnism, Terry Hurlock.
So I never though went up though, but for two reasons. One, because at that stage I was a kid. I couldn't really like just afford to like go to, you know, to Glasgow, you know, for any reason, let alone a match. And the other reason, if I'm honest, was, and it seems so stupid going back, you know, looking back, but I just thought I'll just get my head kicked in. They'll hear my voice and I'll just get my head kicked in. And so I never went, but I just sort of followed. I subscribed to all the fanzines. I'd get these videos. I'd sort of follow it all. But it sort of felt really sad that I never went. And then the first time, as I alluded to earlier, was mid to late 90s. I went to interview Simon Donnelly. And this was, you very rarely interviewed players in their grounds in those days. They'd normally be in a hotel or the training ground. But that time it was in Celtic Park, sat in a changing room, and I interviewed him. And then afterwards, I said, "Oh, can I walk around?" And they said, "No, no, you can't walk around." And I said, "Oh, please." And they said, "Oh, yeah, go on then." And I remember my legs nearly went, like, when I was in there. Obviously, I ran onto the pitch, even though I'd been told not to. And but there was no match. It was just walking around an empty Celtic Park. And so meanwhile,
it's an unbelievable sight, isn't it? Like, yeah. I don't know if this is just as a Celtic fan, because I've been to lots of other grounds. I've been to Old Trafford, and that's kind of the same. But I'll never forget the first time I went to Celtic Park for a Rangers game in particular. And it's just, I can so distinctly remember coming out of the staircase. Out, it's not the tunnel, but you know what I mean? Out of the sort of stairwell, and you just get this wall of Rangers fans. And they're all doing their bit, and all the noise coming from the Celtic fans. And you just think to yourself, even just being part of that park, you think, God, this is what I've watched on TV so long. This is like the myth, but it's in front of me now. And it's, you know, it's just, it sort of stays with you for a long, long time. I've been lucky enough to be on the Celtic Park pitch, myself and Melly and Stephen actually got to play in a charity game a couple of years ago. It was like a Lisbon Lions thing. Unfortunately, we had to be on the Inter Milan team. So we get Inter Milan strips, and we were playing a group of guys that were in Celtic strips. And you just can't believe it. Like, I've got the pictures on my phone, and I look back at them all the time. You know, that you're just like, did I actually do that? And then you're like, fuck, that's unbelievable.
That is a dream. I mean, despite the kit, you know, you know, that is a detail. But you know, to get that sort of far, and to interview Simon Donnelly and just to walk around the grounds and all that, you know, considering that this must have been the, I'm going to guess about 96, 97. So I'd been sort of obsessed with Celtic at that stage since about 89. And it was just absolutely, absolutely unreal. And it sort of felt really sad in a way that it wasn't a match, but also really exciting because obviously you do feel special. Like you said, if you go there on a non-match day and, you know, you're there, I was there for work sort of thing. And I remember, I couldn't believe how, I mean, obviously this was post redevelopment, but I couldn't believe how high it went. I remember I'd never sort of felt that sense that on the telly. And Simon Donnelly, just briefly on the Runner's Code Book, he's actually written a piece, as you know, Melly has as well, as you know. And Simon Donnelly's written a piece as well. And what was funny was I worked out it was, I think, exactly 20 years on or something that I interviewed him. So I tweeted him that day. I said, I'll speak to you in another 20 years then. And at which stage he'll probably still look really great and my decline would have continued. But
it must be the running.
Yeah. Running, yogurt breathing, vegan diet. Yeah, vegan donor for dindids. But anyway, so eventually I describe myself now as a recovering Arsenal fan, as in the social engineering of the new fan base, the moving to a new ground, just I would just end up crying if I talk about it. But what happened to that club is just
terrible. So cliched. It's so cliched when you hear, you know, people when they talk about the English Football League, particularly the Premier League rather, it sounds a bit cliched. It sounds a bit bitter when you hear Scottish football fans coming coming out with it, but there is a degree of truth. It's like Hollywood now. It's kind of like for tourists, and every club seems really intent in sort of flushing out the history and the fan base. They sort of pay homage to the history and all that, but they don't really, you know, they don't want to really carry on. And that's one thing that is so good about being a Celtic fan, you know, that it's carried through, you know, the fan culture, the history of the club. We hold on to that. And it's one thing that I would really, really hate to lose. Like you say, you see it with Arsenal when they left Highbury, Man U, when it's been sold, all these different owners, Man City are just, it's like Man City, Newcastle now, they're almost like franchises as opposed to proper football clubs.
Yeah, what really differentiates these clubs anymore compared to 10, 20 years ago? Very little. And Newcastle will go down that same route. I remember Man City. I mean, there's a danger of sounding sort of condescending at this point. But what I mean is, I remember the thing I loved about Man City was, and I always used to say this about Man City fans, was I remember at Arsenal once, Man City were 3-0 down with 2 minutes to go. They pulled one back and the crowd, the Man City end, stood up. Come on, City, come on, City. As if, you know, giving them that will, like you could win this still. Obviously, they're not going to win it in 2 minutes. Other fan bases would have walked home anyway at that point, or would have left and gone back to the coach. And I loved that about, you know, that was a distinct thing about City. But when I look at it now, they're all so much of muchness. And I can't tell you how much that they did do exactly what you just said. They just drained the identity away. They changed the club, the badge, which is a big thing. They moved the ground. That was awful. That was really, really painful. And they did it on a lie. They said, we're going to do this in order that we can compete with Barcelona and all this sort of stuff. And the club actually declined massively in stature and in results after they left. In fact, still have. It's like they've never, ever come back to what they were at the point they left Highbury. I sort of continued going a lot because I loved Arsene Wenger. I just loved the guy. And that just made it more painful because the way that the fan base, so much of the fan base turned against him, I found like sickening. And I'll always remember the last time I went, it was Wenger announced on the Friday that he was going. And on the Sunday, Arsenal were playing, I think it was either West Ham or Burnley. I think it was West Ham. And I remember just thinking at some stage at the beginning of the match, he's going to walk just before kickoff. He's going to walk down the tunnel. And I just thought, what's going to happen? Like, I hope that there's going to be a massive rapturous applause for him, because even the people who wanted him to go, he's going now. So, and nobody paid the slightest bit of attention. People were looking at their phones, taking selfies, talking about their mortgages. Nobody even noticed that man who, whatever people thought of him, had done so much for the club. Yeah. Nobody gave him any even attention as he appeared. Because why would they? They weren't there, you know, for that. And so that kind of broke it for me. And I just thought, I've got to go to Celtic. I've just got to go up there. It's like I should have done it years ago. And I actually watched a video, I don't know if you know him, from the fan media world, Sogdon. And I saw...
Yeah, I know who he is. Yeah, yeah.
And I saw him go up. Yeah, and I saw him go up to Celtic Park and him go to Celtic Social Club and all that and not come out with his nose splattered all over his face, despite my previous fears that anyone, you know, anyone from south of the border would sort of get. And I just thought, well, if he's going, I'm going.
I don't know if this is a uniquely Celtic thing, but I know myself. You see, whenever you're on holiday or you're away somewhere and you meet someone who's not familiar with Celtic, you're always so keen to share the story of Celtic and what Celtic are and who Celtic are. And I just don't feel I really get that with other football clubs. You know, it's like Celtic fans are like, oh, you need to hear about this, or you don't know about Celtic, or there's this and there's that. And the Lisbon, you know, we're so keen to share the story and share what the fans stand for and the culture and all that that surrounds the club. We want to sort of bring people into that as a sort of more inclusive thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember well, like when I was about 15, 16, going on holiday to Greek Island, like me and my dad went over there. And I remember I was wearing a Celtic shirt the whole holiday. And I remember this guy came up to me who had lived half his life in Glasgow, the other half his life in Greece. And he just sat me down and he was like, you know, he caught that I wasn't like from Glasgow or from Scotland and all that. And he was all interested in my, and he was like, right, let me tell you. And we got absolutely like splattered all over the floor all night. There's a picture on that Axum article of me like midway through the night. And but he just told me so many stories, and I can't tell you like how much he, you know, how proud he was and how welcoming he was. It was like, you know, it's the arms go out. The arms came out when I held out hands and said, can someone send me a video? I got bombarded like every single time. But it was because those two guys in the Boom Six campaign, looking back now, I think they were winding me up, but they loved the fact that I was a Celtic fan. They said, don't go up there, you'll get knifed and all this sort of stuff. And I, You know, I could have been going there all this time. I could have been going there since probably
put you off
since
for 20 odd years.
Possibly since before you went. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's ridiculous. And so I went up to the Hearts match this is February 2020, you know, and got my mate Alan, who is an Arsenal fan. And we went up together, and I just remember walking there from, I think, Belgrove station.
Yeah.
And I was just bricking myself, not because I thought I'm going to get beaten up in most of it, but I just thought, what if it's not what I hoped it was and all that. And I could see the ground in the distance and all of that. And it was just everything I hoped for, times like a million. And I could talk endlessly about what it means to me, but I think it's almost nicer if I say what Alan said, because he's got no Celtic affiliation. But he said two things. He said he's a season ticket holder at Arsenal and he goes to every home match. And he said he had more conversations with other fans one match at Celtic than it had, he thought, in the previous 2 years of every going to every home match at Arsenal. And the other thing was, he just said it reminded him what football was about to go there. Yeah. And this is a man, he's my age. He's been going to Arsenal probably even to football, possibly even longer than I have. He coaches football. He coaches an actual team. But he said it took that to remind him what football was about. And I just remember the guy behind us just shouting all night at the Hearts fans, "You dirty wee Tory rats." And I remember Alan turned around to me. He said, "You'd have come here for that alone, wouldn't you?" And I said, "Absolutely." And holding up the scarf, "Doing You'll Never Walk Alone," felt like some sort of initiation. Like that was the moment where everything sort of clicked into place. 5-0 win. The only thing that didn't go perfectly was I had this idea that I'd do an Instagram story progression where I would have little clumps of "I Want to Be Adored" by Stone Roses.
Yeah, Stone Roses.
And then I would hold off the actual final chorus bit. And when Edward, in my fantasy, inevitably scored and the fans all inevitably chanted the thing, that would be the culmination. Only I could go to a 5-0 win in which an on-form Edward was playing, but him not score. So that one, when everyone was like, "What happened to your story?" I was like, "Oh, don't worry about that.
I didn't go to plan." I
went back the next morning for a stadium tour, got in an Uber. The driver was a Celtic fan. We were like singing Rebs all the way from my Airbnb to there. And it was brilliant. Went back again a couple of weeks later, St Mirren. The last match before lockdown, as it turned out, 5-0. The guy next to me spent most of the match telling me he didn't think Rona would be a big problem. I hope he's doing well. 5-0. I did get an Edouard goal that time. I got a Lee Griffiths hat trick. God, that takes you back. But it's kind of really, really weird to me that I'm so happy I went that time. Honestly, I consider it genuinely one of the best decisions I've made in my life, not just in football and anything, to finally go. I'm just so glad I did it. But I also just find it so almost freaky and disturbing that, you know, I left that Hearts match and I was like, I'm going to go every single time I can. Whenever I can, I'm coming up here. I'm having that vegan haggis pizza at Pizza Punk's on the way along and I've got it all sorted out. And then football just stops for about a year. And even when it starts again, Celtic are, I mean, one of the most bizarre sort of things I've ever known of any club.
I mean, it's last season was a difficult one in more ways than one, but you know, just so unfortunate, because as you started supporting Celtic, we seem to be on the cusp of making history. And you're like, right, I'm going to get to witness this. And then, you know, all our dreams are shattered in one. You'll need to come back up for some games. We'll need to catch up when you get back up here and get to a couple of games with you. You're vegan. I'm not going to dwell too long on the vegan thing. I just want to say that you've really put me on to vegan doner and vegan shawarma. I have it all the time. Can't recommend it enough. I recommend it to everyone on my Instagram. Cannot recommend it enough.
Which have Vivera?
Vivera. Yeah, that's well nice. So when you talk about it, I'm like, I need to try this. So I tried it, and you can't taste the difference. And it's easier to cook, easier to clean, easier on the environment. No animals are harmed. So no, it's that's the way you've turned me. Actually, not just that, I've actually moved on to vegan sausages now. So I don't eat regular sausages.
Brilliant.
So I've moved on to the vegan sausages and the vegan shawarma and the vegan kebabs. So yeah, and on that note. I think this is a brilliant place to wrap up. I've really enjoyed that, Chaz. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Let's do the usual. Where can people find you on social media if they want to check out your book? I'm assuming it's available on Amazon, but you're better telling people where they can get it and all that sort of stuff.
Yep, The Runner's Code, yeah, available on Amazon. If anyone wants to go and request it at any bookstores, they'd be doing me a big favour, but you can get it online. If not, The Runner's Code by Chaz Newkey Burden. Unfortunately, that's my name. My Twitter handle and my Instagram handle are All That Chaz. And right, you can hear me plug my book and talk about Vegan Donna on there, as if you've not had enough already.
And we'll obviously retweet your account. And when this podcast comes out, you know, there'll be stuff in the show notes and I'll link to Chaz's socials and all that if you want to check it out. Thanks so much, Chaz. I've been really looking forward to this. It's been long overdue. You've been listening to the podcast. You've been a big supporter of us and we're very, very appreciative of it. So it's been long overdue. We've been wanting to get you on the pod for a while. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. All I can say again is that when I'm running, I'm always listening to 20 Minute Tims. And it's like you guys have genuinely become, in all sincerity, like the soundtrack, I think, to a lot of our lives, particularly over the last sort of year when the content, I think you've upped how much content you do. And what I just want to say is, and I've always wanted to say this, is like, it's really, really hard to do irreverence in football commentary and to be actual proper fans. I know lots of people who can be irreverent about football, but they don't actually like football, and that's how they get to be irreverent and piss-takey about it. But there's no doubt that the three of you, you know, you absolutely bleed Celtic, and yet you manage to be really, really funny about it. And I don't think any of you three probably realise how rare and how brilliant that is. And so thank you for entertaining us, and never ever stop doing the Friday phone-in, or at least if you ever do stop it, give us at least a year's warning so we can get therapy.
Impossible. I want to thank you so much for that. Impossible to stop the Friday phone-in because it's my favourite podcast. It's my favourite one. Thank you so much, Chaz, and I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favourite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.